Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Challenging Cases from the Clinic, the treatment-naive patient with chronic HCV infection, which is certified by the AGA Institute and presented by Ira M. Jacobson, MD. Dr. Jacobson is a Vincent Astor Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College, Chief of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, New York Presbyterian Hospital, New York, New York. Dr. Jacobson has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Anatus Pharmaceuticals, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Genentech, Gilead Sciences, Globimmune, Human Genome Sciences, Merck & Company, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Pfizer, Pharmacet, Roche, Shearing Plough Corporation, Tibotec, Vertex Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, and Zymogenetics. He served as an advisor or consultant for Abbott Laboratories, Achillion Pharmaceuticals, Anatus Pharmaceuticals, Biolex, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Genentech, Gilead Sciences, GlaxoSmithKline, Globimmune, Human Genome Sciences, Merck & Company, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Pfizer, Roche, Sanofi Aventis, Shearing Plough Corporation, Vertex Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, Pharmacet, Tibotec, and Zymogenetics. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Genentech, Gilead Sciences, Merck & Company, Roche, and Shearing Plough Corporation. Dr. Jacobson does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Jacobson does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to address practice gaps in HCV screening, diagnosis, referral, and treatment, and help change the course of the urgent public crisis of undiagnosed and untreated chronic HCV infection. This activity is supported by Merck & Company and Vertex Pharmaceuticals. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ira Jacobson from the Weill Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York City. Welcome to this Medscape CME certified program titled Challenging Cases from the Clinic. I'm going to present a case of a treatment-naive patient with genotype 1 chronic hepatitis C. This was a 47-year-old man with HCV genotype 1B infection, who probably, based on his history of risk factors, acquired his infection about 25 years previously. The patient was asymptomatic and otherwise in good health. He had a brother who had cirrhosis from hepatitis C and had tolerated interferon poorly, which affected the patient's perspective on treatment initially. A liver biopsy 3 years previous to the current presentation showed grade 2 inflammation and stage 1 or portal fibrosis, and as mentioned, the patient was reluctant to undertake a course of therapy with the then standard course of PEG interferon and ribavirin. The patient's physical examination at the time of this presentation was unremarkable. There were no signs of chronic liver disease. His CBC was normal, including his hemoglobin, white blood count, and platelets. His ALT was mildly elevated at 65 with an AST of 35. His bilirubin, albumin, protein, INR, and alpha-fetoprotein levels were normal. And he had a modestly high HCV RNA viral level of 1.2 million international units per mil. Again, his HCV genotype was 1B. Imaging with MRI showed a small hemangioma in the right lobe of the liver. There were no changes suggestive of advanced fibrosis, nor were there any focal liver lesions. At this time, the patient underwent a repeat liver biopsy, and he had stage 1 to 2 or Medivir F1 to 2 fibrosis, signifying the formation of a few septa and slight progression of his fibrosis relative to the biopsy 3 years before. The patient entered a clinical trial with the HCV protease inhibitor, telaprevir, which at the time was investigational. He was treated with peg interferon alpha-2A, 180 micrograms per week, ribavirin 1,200 milligrams daily, and telaprevir 750 milligrams every 8 hours, given orally. I'd like to show you the design and then the results of the pivotal phase 3 trial with telaprevir in treatment-naive patients with HCV genotype 1. And I would emphasize at this point that both recently approved protease inhibitors, telaprevir and bisoprevir, are only approved for patients with genotype 1 hepatitis C virus infection. The ADVANCE trial was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial for telaprevir, but all patients received peg interferon alpha-2A and ribavirin. There were 3 arms in the study, 2 of them involving the receipt of telaprevir plus peg interferon and ribavirin at the outset. In the first arm, patients received triple therapy for 12 weeks, followed by peg interferon and ribavirin alone. In the second arm, patients received 8 weeks of telaprevir and peg interferon and ribavirin, followed by placebo for 4 weeks plus peg and riba, followed by peg riba. And the third arm was a control group who received the standard of care of peg interferon and ribavirin for 48 weeks. If we go back to the first 2 arms for a moment, we can see that if patients attained what has become known as an extended rapid virologic response, represented by undetectability of HCV RNA in the plasma with a very sensitive PCR assay at both week 4 and week 12 of therapy, they were assigned to stop their treatment after a total of 24 weeks, representing either 12 or 8 weeks of triple therapy, followed by 12 or 16 weeks of peg interferon and ribavirin. If the patients failed to attain an ERVR, as I've just defined it for you, they received 48 weeks of total therapy, represented by either 36 or 40 weeks of peg interferon ribavirin, followed by the initial course of triple therapy. There were stopping rules in this trial. All clinicians have become familiar with stopping rules with peg interferon and ribavirin for a number of years, represented most prominently by the policy of stopping therapy after 12 weeks if there's a failure to attain a viral load reduction of 2 logs or 100-fold, because we've learned that that's highly predictive of ultimate failure of therapy. We've instituted the futility rules with peg interferon and ribavirin to avoid exposing patients to an additional period of therapy that has known toxicities in the face of ultimate futility. That's one important rationale for including stopping of futility rules with protease inhibitor-based therapy, but the other important rationale for doing so is the wish to avoid the emergence of resistant viruses, that is, variants that have amino acid substitutions that confer a reduced sensitivity or resistance to telaprevir or bisoprevir or other direct-acting antiviral agents that are in the process of being developed. In the ADVANCE trial, the week 4 stopping rule, which applied to telaprevir-treated patients only, was that if your HCV RNA was more than 1,000 IU per mil, you discontinued telaprevir but continued peg interferon ribavirin. You'll note a little later in my discussion how the stopping rule that's been adopted for clinical practice in the package insert has changed somewhat. At week 12 in the ADVANCE trial, if the HCV RNA failed to decline by 2 logs, you discontinued all treatment consistent with the standard of care at the time. And from weeks 24 to 40, any detectable level of HCV RNA also was to lead to discontinuation of all therapy, again consistent with the prevailing standard of care. This slide shows the top-line SVR, or sustained virologic response rates, in telaprevir-treated patients compared to peg interferon and ribavirin alone. In the 12-week telaprevir group, which I will refer to as the T12PR group, the SVR rate was 75%. In the T8PR group, it was 69%. And the control patients had a rather standard or typical rate of SVR that we've come to associate with peg interferon, ribavirin, and genotype 1 infected patients of 44%. And you can see the highly statistically significant advantages of having received telaprevir in either the T12 or the T8 arms. We see a slight arithmetic advantage to the T12 regimen, and I'll show you in a moment what we think the real underlying advantage of the extra 4 weeks of telaprevir is in the form of reduced rates of virologic failure. RVR, a term that we've used for a number of years to denote undetectability of HCV RNA at week 4, occurred far more frequently with telaprevir than without it, either 68 or 66% in the T12 and T8 groups, respectively, or 9%, again a very representative or well-reported rate of RVR with peginterferon and ribavirin alone. Patients with extended rapid virologic response comprise 58 and 57% of the telaprevir-treated groups, but only 8% of the patients who received peginterferon and ribavirin. And I'd like to remind you that this represents precisely the number of patients who are eligible, if they received telaprevir, to stop therapy after 24 weeks. So over half of the patients in the study were assigned to 24 weeks of therapy by the design of the study. This slide shows the rates of sustained virologic response by ERVR status. And we can see on the left that amongst patients who had an extended rapid virologic response, the T12 patients had SVR rates of 89%, the 8-week telaprevir-treated patients 83%, and we do have to note that amongst the patients who received peginterferon and ribavirin who had an ERVR, the SVR rate was very high at 97%, but they had to receive a standard 48-week regimen instead of the 24-week regimen to which the telaprevir-treated patients who had an ERVR were assigned. And you'll also note in the denominators along the x-axis the far lower number of patients who received peginterferon and ribavirin who actually had an ERVR. Amongst the patients who failed to have an ERVR, the rates of SVR in these patients who all received 48 weeks of treatment were 54%, 50%, and 39%. Now, I'd like to digress for just a moment off the slide and point out that there are differences in the SVR rates in the package insert for telaprevir on the one hand and the rates reported in the New England Journal publication recently. And this is because of a reanalysis of the SVR data that was requested by the FDA, submitted to it, and were considered appropriate to put in the package insert. And those revised SVR rates in the package insert were 79%, 72%, and 46% for the T12, T8, and PR groups, respectively. And if we look at the orange bar on the slide in front of us, showing the 89% SVR rate for the patients in the T12 group who had an ERVR, the reanalysis of SVR resulted in an SVR rate in this group of 92% rather than 89%. The relapse rates in the advanced study are shown on this slide, and you'll note the markedly lower rates of relapse with telaprevir as compared with peginterferon and ribavirin alone. Indeed, amongst patients who actually completed their regimens, the relapse rates were lower than those for the overall cohorts, as we might expect, at 6 and 7%, respectively, in the T12 and T8 groups, and 27% with peginterferon and ribavirin. Again, a very representative figure for relapse in the historic literature in this field. This slide shows the real difference, as I suggested we can think of it before, between the T12 and T8 groups. The slide shows overall on-treatment rates of virologic failure, and these were lower in patients receiving 12 weeks of telaprevir. The legend at the top of the slide shows the various criteria that were used in this study to comprise virologic failure. And we can see if we compare the T12 groups, shown in orange, and the T8 group, shown in blue, that 3% of the patients in each of those groups had virologic failure during the first 12 weeks. But the story of the difference between T12 and T8 is shown beyond 12 weeks, where twice the number of patients in the T8 group had virologic failure. And this was due to reemergence or detectability of a greater level of wild-type and low-level resistant variants of the virus in the T8 group, suggesting overall that the T12 regimen with the extra 4 weeks of telaprevir more effectively eradicated wild-type and low-level resistant variants during the initial 12-week phase of the trial. I would also point out that virologic failure was somewhat more common in genotype 1A than 1B because of the different barriers to resistance that we now know exist. Two protease inhibitors, and in particular telaprevir as well as bisoprevir, which I'll discuss in a few moments, between genotypes 1A and 1B. So for the first time in the history of treating hepatitis C, genotype 1 subtype matters just a little bit because these differences in barrier to resistance are reflected in slight but real differences in rates of sustained virologic response. This slide shows SVR rates by fibrosis stage in the ADVANCE trial, and we can see that patients who have bridging fibrosis or cirrhosis who've long been recognized to have lower SVR rates with PEG interferon and ribavirin, a finding that was again reproduced in this study, that they do have a marked increment in SVR to as high as 62% in the T12 group, still not as good, however, as the 78% in the patients who were in the T12 group who had no mild or portal fibrosis. So advanced fibrosis still matters, but much of the gap is overcome by the addition of telaprevir. A similar theme prevails when we examine SVR rates by race or ethnicity. We've known for years that for reasons that have only recently become at least partially clarified, that Black or African-American patients have substantially impaired chances of sustained virologic response when they receive interferon-based therapy for hepatitis C. And here we see a fairly representative rate of SVR of 25% with PEG interferon and ribavirin in the Black or African-American patients, which goes all the way up to 62% in the T12 group and 58% in the T8 group. Again, the rates of SVR even with telaprevir don't quite come up to the rates in the overall study population, but the impairment of response is substantially overcome by the addition of a potent direct-acting antiviral agent. This slide shows the adverse events leading to discontinuation and most common adverse events with telaprevir or without telaprevir, and what I'd simply like to point out is that the major side effects that were incrementally greater in frequency with telaprevir than without it are the ones that are shown shaded: pruritus, nausea, rash, anemia, and diarrhea. In addition, as noted on the bottom of the slide, anorectal symptoms under a variety of descriptors, such as hemorrhoids or itching, occurred in 29% of patients with telaprevir versus 7% without it. Now, I'd like to point out that rash, as referred to on this slide, reflects differences in rates of rash as precisely recorded as such by investigators on the forms that we use to report side effects. So we see rates of rash per se at 37 and 35% with telaprevir versus 24% without it. I'll show you a little more information about overall dermatologic events momentarily. This slide shows that the rate of discontinuation for adverse events with telaprevir or placebo during that phase of the trial was 11% in the T12 group, 7% in the T8 group, and 1% in the control group. But rates of discontinuation of the overall regimen occurred in 10%, 10%, and 7%, respectively. Severe rash was managed by sequential discontinuation of telaprevir, followed 7 days later by ribavirin, and, if indicated, PEG interferon for continued progression. This was distinct from the strategy in the phase 2 development program, where the whole regimen was discontinued for severe rash. And the strategy of sequential discontinuation, as embodied in the phase 3 development program and shown on this slide, is the one that is recommended for adoption in clinical practice. This slide shows that another important adverse effect of telaprevir is a modest increase in the degree of hemoglobin decline to the tune of a little over a mean of an extra gram per deciliter of hemoglobin drop, as shown in the graph on the right. And, of course, we're all familiar with the anemia induced by PEG interferon and ribavirin from our historical experience and the literature. At the upper left, we see that patients who took telaprevir had a reduction in hemoglobin at nadir to less than 10 grams per deciliter of 38% compared to 14% of controls. And amongst those, not representing a separate group but subsumed under the larger group of hemoglobin declines to less than 10, those who went to less than 8.5 grams at nadir were 9% with telaprevir and 2% with PEG interferon and ribavirin. The text on the lower left of the slide shows that overall, relatively few patients discontinued telaprevir because of anemia, and even fewer discontinued the overall regimen due to anemia events. The graph on the right shows the difference in hemoglobin decline, at least the mean decline, between PEG-RIBA, shown in the white curve, and patients on telaprevir, shown in blue and orange. And if we contrast the blue and orange lines, the blue line representing the T8 group, we see that after telaprevir was stopped at the 8th week, or for that matter, after telaprevir was stopped after the 12th week, that the hemoglobin began to rise fairly rapidly, and by week 24, the level of hemoglobin approximated that seen with peg interferon and ribavirin alone. Now, the ADVANCE trial was a pivotal phase 3 study in which patients were assigned to 24 weeks of therapy if they had what we've called an ERVR, extended rapid virologic response. And as we've seen, the results of the trial provide a strong foundation for thinking that 24 weeks is sufficient therapy for patients who have an ERVR if telaprevir-based therapy is used. The ILLUMINATE study was a supportive phase 3 program or trial that actually randomized patients who had an ERVR to 24 versus 48 weeks after receiving telaprevir. So we can see that patients received 12 weeks of triple therapy up front, followed by 12 weeks of peg interferon and ribavirin, and if ERVR was attained, patients either were randomized to stop therapy after 24 weeks, or they went out to 48 weeks, while patients who failed to have an ERVR were automatically assigned to 48 weeks of therapy. And the only slide from the results section of the ILLUMINATE trial that I'd like to show shows the SVR rates with an intent to treat SVR rate of 72%. This was actually revised to 74% at the time of the FDA approval process with that reanalysis that I mentioned. But the most important two bars here are the blue bars because they show that the primary non-inferiority endpoint was indeed attained for the 24-week regimen with 92% rates of SVR in the 24-week treatment recipients versus 88% in the patients with ERVR who got 48 weeks of therapy. And overall, we think these two trials together provide an extremely firm foundation for using response-guided therapy, that is, truncating therapy to a total treatment duration of 24 weeks following an ERVR in treatment-naive patients with genotype 1 HCV infection. So going back to our patient, this slide shows his course from weeks 4 through week 24 with a modest degree of leukopenia and neutropenia, not requiring any dose reductions, and this is consistent with peg interferon, of course, a modest degree of anemia to a nadir hemoglobin of 11.2, which actually came up a little bit to 12.0 at week 24. That represents a time point 12 weeks after the telaprevir had been stopped, a mild degree of thrombocytopenia, and an ALT level that gradually declined, although remained slightly elevated for much of the time through week 24. But his HCV RNA became undetectable very quickly at week 4 and remained so at week 12 and week 24. So this patient received 24 weeks of total therapy in accordance with the fact that he had attained an extended rapid virologic response. This shows the patient's adverse events. He had flu-like symptoms early, which is characteristic of interferon. He did complain of fatigue much of the time and also noted anal itching starting at week 4. He also noted dry patches on his face, particularly around the nasal folds, starting at the second month. And then he noticed an erythematous raised pruritic rash on his arms, chest, back, and legs starting at week 8, which he treated with topical steroids. His rash remained stable through week 12, and when he stopped telaprevir, the rash began to resolve, and by week 16, it had resolved everywhere but his legs, specifically his shins, and the rash had cleared by the 24th week of therapy. All the patient's side effects resolved after he stopped his treatment regimen, and he was left at follow-up week 24 with an ALT, clearly in the normal range at 26, and happily for the patient, an undetectable HCV RNA representing attainment of sustained virologic response. Stopping rules for telaprevir that have been incorporated into the package insert are important to know in order to appropriately treat our patients, and I underscore them here because they do differ somewhat from the stopping rules that have been incorporated into the pivotal trials. And these stopping rules are based on retrospective analysis of how patients fared if they failed to attain certain parameters of response that are embodied in these stopping rules. So specifically at week 4 of telaprevir-based therapy, if the HCV RNA is more than 1,000 international units per mil, the patient is supposed to stop not just the telaprevir, as was done in the pivotal trials, but stop all the therapy. At week 12, similarly, if the HCV RNA is more than 1,000 IU per mil, all therapy is to be stopped. And at week 24, which is reminiscent of the peg-riba era, any level of detectable HCV RNA should again lead to discontinuation of all therapy. This slide shows the response-guided therapy algorithm for telaprevir in the package insert for the drug. Patients who are treatment naive, as well as relapsers, get 24 weeks of total therapy if they attain an extended rapid virologic response. So we call this a T12-PR24 regimen. And please note the inclusion of relapsers in this algorithm, even though in the phase 3 pivotal trial of treatment-experienced patients in which relapsers were included in large numbers, they all received 48 weeks of therapy. Subsequent analyses of phase 2 data and the overall high level of responsiveness of prior relapsers led to the inclusion of relapsers as being eligible for response-guided therapy in the package insert. If patients fail to attain ERVR, they receive 48 weeks of therapy, a T12-PR48 regimen, and non-responders, whether prior partial or null responders, also receive 48 weeks of total therapy. The package insert indicates that treatment-naive patients with cirrhosis and ERVR may benefit from an additional 36 weeks of peginterferon and ribavirin. And this represents implicitly an acknowledgement of the fact that there were not large numbers of cirrhotics in the pivotal phase 3 development program for the drug, and the fact that since the stakes are so high for cirrhotic patients, we always want to err, of course, on the side of doing whatever we can to ensure that they have an optimal chance of attaining an SVR and to minimize the chance of relapse. No doubt further studies will be done of cirrhotic patients to further address this issue, but that is what the package insert says for treatment-naive patients with cirrhosis. Now, because both telaprevir and bisaprevir, another HCV protease inhibitor, have been approved very recently and contemporaneously, I'd like to take just a couple of moments to outline some of the findings from the pivotal phase 3 study in treatment-naive genotype 1 infected patients with bisaprevir. And this study also had three arms, with a control group that received peginterferon alpha-2b plus ribavirin for 48 weeks. At the bottom, in yellow, we see that another arm of patients received peginterferon and ribavirin plus bisaprevir for a total treatment duration of 48 weeks. And I'd like to point out that all the patients in this study, indeed all the patients in the phase 3 development program, received a lead-in phase of peginterferon and ribavirin for the first 4 weeks. In the third treatment arm shown in the middle, patients received the lead-in phase of peg-riba, as I've mentioned, and then bisaprevir was added, just as it was in the arm shown at the bottom. And this was the arm that was designed to explore response-guided therapy with bisaprevir. If patients attained HCV RNA undetectability at treatment week 8, which represents 4 weeks of lead-in plus 4 weeks of triple therapy, and maintained that undetectability through week 24, they stopped after a total treatment duration of 28 rather than 24 weeks, 4 weeks of lead-in and 24 weeks of triple therapy. If patients had detectable HCV RNA at treatment week 8 or at any point through week 20 but became undetectable by week 24, those patients stopped the bisaprevir at total treatment week 28 but received a peginterferon ribavirin tail, if you will, for another 20 weeks for a total of 48 weeks of therapy. And this slide shows the rates of sustained virologic response and relapse in the two cohorts of this study. The study indeed was divided into cohort 1, which consisted of non-black patients, and cohort 2, which comprised black patients. And this study design was conceived because of the historical underrepresentation of black or African American patients in many prior HCV studies and the desire to derive as much data as possible in this important population. So on the left, we can see that the cohort 1 or non-black patients had SVR rates of 40% with peg-riba and 67% with response-guided therapy, or RGT, 68% with 48 weeks of therapy, representing parity in rates of SVR with response-guided therapy versus 48 weeks. You'll note the same kind of reduction in relapse rates with bisaprevir in this trial relative to control therapy that we talked about with telaprevir a few minutes ago. In cohort 2, the black patients, the SVR rates were lower, 23%, and 42% with bisaprevir given as response-guided therapy compared to 53% for 48 weeks. In a modified intent-to-treat analysis in which patients who got only patients who received at least one dose of bisoprolol were included. The rates of SVR were more similar at 47 and 53% respectively. This slide shows rates of SVR by response pattern in cohort 1, or the non-black cohort. If patients had an HCV RNA that was undetectable from weeks 8 to 24 and stopped at week 28, they had exceedingly high rates of SVR whether they received response-guided therapy, namely stopping at 28 weeks of total therapy, or whether they received 48 weeks of therapy. And so again, these data provide a firm foundation for the adoption of response-guided therapy, provided appropriate parameters of early and robust response are attained. In patients who were later responders, that is detectable at week 8 but undetectable by week 24, we also see similarities in the rates of SVR, whether the patients stopped their bisoprolol after week 28 and went on and received another 20 weeks of PEGRIBA or got all three drugs for a total treatment duration of 48 weeks, 4 weeks of lead-in and 44 weeks of triple therapy. When the cohorts were combined in the New England Journal paper, it was said that 44% of all patients from both cohorts were eligible for the shorter treatment duration. And in the overall study, and this was presented at the FDA advisory hearing in late April, late responders had an SVR rate of 66% with response-guided therapy versus 75% with 48 weeks of therapy. And this was thought to represent a potentially meaningful difference, albeit not statistically significant based on the numbers in this study. And that's why the approved regimen of response-guided therapy for late responders who are treatment naive actually consists of 4 weeks of lead-in, 32 weeks of triple therapy instead of the 24 weeks that was studied in the SPRINT 2 trial, and then a 12-week PEG interferon and ribavirin tail. And I'll show you that again in a moment. This slide lists the most common treatment-related adverse events, and the two main differentiators in terms of being more common with bisoprolol were anemia and dysgeusia. With a similar rate of incremental hemoglobin decline of a gram to a gram and a half that we discussed with telaprevir a short time ago. I want to underscore on this slide the rates of discontinuation due to adverse events, which were quite similar across all three treatment arms, and then the under hematologic parameters underscores quantitatively the number of patients whose hemoglobins got down to less than 10 or less than 8.5 grams. And we can see that the numbers are higher with bisoprolol than without it, and that there were more dose reductions, notably of ribavirin, due to anemia when patients received bisoprolol as opposed to PEG interferon and ribavirin alone. You'll note that one important distinction between the bisoprolol and telaprevir studies, although not mentioned moments ago, with telaprevir is that EPO use was permitted in the bisoprolol program, but not in the telaprevir program. Finally, at the bottom, you'll note a slight increment in at least moderate neutropenia when patients receive bisoprolol compared to PEG-RIBA alone. But it's unclear whether there are any clinical implications of this. So I'd just like to conclude with the stopping rules for bisoprolol, and like those with telaprevir, these have been harmonized across both treatment-naive and experienced patients in the package insert for bisoprolol in this case. At week 12, if HCV RNA is greater than or equal to 100 IU per mil, all therapy is to be stopped because of the data suggesting futility if the HCV RNA is higher than that. And at week 24, again reminiscent of PEG-RIBA, if the HCV RNA is detectable, all therapy is to be stopped. Finally, this is the algorithm for response-guided therapy with bisoprolol. In treatment-naive patients, if the HCV RNA is undetectable at weeks 8 through 24 inclusive, patients receive a total of 28 weeks of therapy, 4 weeks of PEG interferon, and 24 weeks of triple therapy. For patients who are detectable at week 8 but subsequently undetectable, 48 weeks of therapy, as I mentioned, with 4 weeks of lead-in, triple therapy for 32 weeks, and PEG-RIBA for the last 12 weeks. In relapsers and partial responders, those being the two populations who were respectively enrolled in the RESPOND 2 study that we're not covering in this talk, but was for patients who were treatment experienced, if HCV RNA was undetectable at weeks 8 and 24, patients receive a total of 36 weeks of therapy, 4 weeks of lead-in, 32 weeks of triple therapy, and for later responders, 48 weeks, with 4 weeks of lead-in, 32 weeks of triple therapy, and 12 more weeks of PEG interferon ribavirin. Finally, for null responders who are approved for this treatment with bisoprolol, but who were not prospectively enrolled into the phase 3 treatment experience trial, 48 weeks of treatment is to be given. And this package insert also specifies that cirrhotics should be treated for 48 weeks. That is, that cirrhotics are not eligible for response-guided therapy. Thank you very much for participating in this activity. To proceed to the online CME test, please click on the Earn CME credit link on this page. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Challenging Cases from the Clinic, the treatment-naive patient with chronic HCV infection. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.